The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to
discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Being more creative is like getting more exercise. Sounds like a great goal, but who has the time? Well, artist Danny Gregory is here to tell you in the gentlest, least judgy way that everybody has the time to be an artist, including you. Gregory is co-founder of thesketchbookschool.com, which offers online art classes, and he's also author of several books, most recently Art Before Breakfast, a zillion ways to be more creative no matter how busy you are. Danny Gregory, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Yes, great to be here.
So your book is titled Art Before Breakfast, and having read it, you mean that very literally. We're supposed to draw before breakfast?
Get up 5 minutes early and have that time for yourself. For all those people who say, I have no time, you have that time.
5 minutes?
Skip brushing.
Really?
You could skip brushing your teeth.
We can't condone that on the radio. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's just a matter of hopping out of bed because you're so excited that you're going to go and draw. It's also a matter of taking that time when perhaps the coffee is dripping or the toaster is doing its thing. You have a couple minutes, and it's possible to do a little drawing in that time. And if you do that every day, then eventually you'll start to make more time because you'll realize how cool it is to draw.
So give me a first step for a wannabe artist.
Well, get a sketchbook. Doesn't have to be an expensive or complicated sketchbook, or it could just be a notepad and a pen. I like people to draw with a pen because I think that forces you to kind of commit to what you're doing. If you draw with a pencil, you might erase it a lot. And then just look at what you're going to draw. Look at it for a minute of the five that you've devoted to this. Look at it for a minute and then slowly start to draw the outline of the edge of the thing that you're looking at. Keep your eyes about 80% of the time on the thing you're looking at, not at your drawing. And just go from there. Draw a mug of coffee. It's fascinating how you think you know what a mug of coffee looks like, but when you actually look at it and you look at the reflections, you look at the shadows, you start to see all kinds of additional things in it, and that's what makes it really interesting.
Okay, so I've got a sheet of paper and a pen in front of me right now. I've got, let's see, one, two, three, four producers in the next room who are doing the same thing. So can you walk us through a good exercise for starters?
Sure. How about drawing your hand?
Oh my.
Put your hand like loosely on the table next to you, relaxed with a palm up and the fingers kind of bent. And then put your pen on the paper. Start on the left-hand side if you're right-handed and slowly draw just the outline of what you see.
Okay, doing that. Wow, in your idea about looking at things first, I don't think I've looked at the inside of my hand in a while.
I know. It's the irony is we say you know it like the back of your hand, when actually the back of your hand is something you probably never even studied. But so once you've drawn that outline, then you might want to go in and you might want to sort of indicate where the kind of wrinkly folds are in between your fingers. That's part of the interesting thing about doing this kind of observational drawing is you start to notice all these things that you'd never seen before, how many lines there are, you know, how they crisscross each other. So in a couple of minutes, you can get to know your hand an awful lot better.
So I'm getting word from the control room that Maureen, our senior producer, is not happy with her hand so far. So what would you tell Maureen right now to talk her down of scrapping the whole thing?
Well, I would say it's less about the final drawing. It's less about like, does this look like a photograph of my hand? And it's more about the journey that you're taking. So when you're first starting to draw, you know, you're doing something that it's quite possible you haven't done since you were 7 or 8 years old. And now suddenly here you are on the radio picking up a pen and doing it for the first time in decades. So of course you're not that great at it. So instead what you want to concentrate on is just the experience, to quiet that voice in your mind that's telling you that you're not doing it properly, and instead just slowly kind of get into a meditative state where you're observing these lines in your hand and you're just tracing them and copying them one at a time. It's really about that process of slowing down, observing, and recording what you're doing. So doing that 3 minutes here, 4 minutes there, a couple times a day, in a week or so, you'll have a completely transformed experience and you'll be delighted with every single drawing you ever do for the rest of your life, I promise.
So is it all about drawing? I mean, you give us a lot of tips about drawing and getting things drawn, but you know, that's not the only creative habit. Is this some sort of trigger or floodgate?
Yeah, I like to think of it as like a gateway sort of activity. Drawing is something that when we were little, we all did. You know, every single person on earth, when they were 4 or 5 years old, given a box of crayons, knew exactly what to do with them. And since then, we've developed a lot of resistance to this idea of drawing. And once you start to draw, you break down that resistance. Once you start to get the thrill of it and you do one drawing out of 10, perhaps, that delights you, then suddenly you'll start to think to yourself, well, what else can I do that I didn't think I could do? You know, and maybe you'll take cooking lessons next, or maybe you'll start to play the piano. There's all kinds of other things you can do, but drawing, because it's so basic, because it's something we all know how to do, even though we deny it, it's a great way to begin to break down this resistance we have to our own creativity. And it also, it doesn't involve many tools or really much time if you do it in these small increments. It's about developing a creative habit, and that habit could take you in lots of different directions. It took me all the way to going to clown school. if you can imagine such a thing. But, you know, I just sort of thought, like, well, what else can I do? Because I started drawing when I was in my mid-30s, and then I discovered, wow, I actually can kind of do this, and I'm not bad at it. So then I started watercoloring, which is something I never thought I could do, and then I started learning how to bind books, and then before long, I was doing all kinds of other crazy things.
You're referring in this conversation, and there's a lot of this in the book about getting into the habit, that you, as if you're building a muscle. Is there a creative muscle?
Oh, absolutely. Creativity is about forming associations between disparate things. Creativity is about overcoming your own sort of calcified preconceptions about things. So just like you just had that experience in drawing your hand, where suddenly you saw it differently than you had before, you started to observe it. What you were doing there is you were overcoming this preconception that you had about what your hand looked like. If I hadn't told you to look at your hand, but had just asked you to draw it, you probably could have drawn something that would look kind of like a glove. So the process of creativity is about seeing things differently than you thought they were. And you start to change your conception of yourself and who you are. You know, suddenly you can start thinking of yourself as a creative person. You don't have to be a professional artist with a one-man show at the Guggenheim to be an artist. You can be a creative person, you know, by the way that you dress or cook dinner or doodle on the while you're on the phone. There's lots of ways to change how you think about yourself. And I think that that's the essence of creativity, is breaking down the rules. And that's how we solve problems. That's how human beings always have.
I'm speaking with the artist Danny Gregory, author of a beautifully illustrated book that he hopes will help you realize your creative self. It's called Art Before Breakfast, A Zillion Ways to Be Creative, No Matter How Busy You Are. Were you referring to art with a capital A, I guess, rather than art with a lowercase a? What is the difference for you?
Art with a capital A is the art that we go to look at. We go to a museum. We go to a gallery. You know, it's art that's bought and sold. It's art that's made by an industry, in a way. And art with a lowercase a is art that just regular people make. We make it as part of our life. It's really the difference between saying, if you said to yourself, I would like to have a grilled cheese sandwich, but I can't cook. I couldn't open a 4-star restaurant. I couldn't be like Gordon Ramsay on TV. So therefore, I'm not going to make a grilled cheese sandwich. So what I'm saying is, go ahead, you know, make art in these small ways, in these ways that just kind of fit in your life, reflect your life, and don't judge them by the standards of capital A art. You're not making art that can go in a museum. You may not even be making art that can hang on a wall, maybe not even on a refrigerator. You know, you're just making it for yourself to have that experience. And it's kind of like the activity that you might have if you go to the gym. You know, there's a lot of things that you do at the gym that are activities, but they're not necessarily things that you do in your regular life. So you may not necessarily normally pick up 100-pound weight, but you do that at the gym to develop those muscles. And that's art making with a capital, with a small a, is that same kind of thing. It's just this process of integrating creativity into your life without judgment, without comparison, and without anxiety, hopefully.
But we go to the gym because we're told that it's going to, you know, help us fight obesity and make our lives longer and make us, give us more energy. Why invest time in becoming a novice at art? Why take on one more thing?
Because I think it's a primal thing. It's a core thing in what we are. I think we go to the gym to exercise because we don't have that in our natural lives anymore, right? We're sitting at desks, we're living in houses, and so we have to go to the gym in order to make up for that. Similarly, if we're living a life where we spend a lot of time looking at things that other people have made, watching TV, reading things that other people have written on our phones, we're not making, we're just consuming. But essential to being a human being is the act of making stuff. You know, we've always done it, and it is, you know, a key way that we are able to connect with the world around us. We're able to see things as they truly are rather than how we imagine them to be. It just, it provides a stronger connection to reality. It also is relaxing. It's meditative. It strengthens your memory. It's like so many things that one can do. You just need to learn a few basic skills to do it. And the things that we usually run into, the resistance that we have, is that we feel like we can't do it. We do a drawing, it doesn't look like we thought it was going to turn out, and so we give up right away. But instead, making it part of your everyday life, by making it a regular habit, you will develop those skills remarkably quickly. That will suddenly give you a sense of mastery, and that will take you into new directions. And the more we strengthen our creative abilities, the more facile we become, the more easy we can make connections. It's all a part of really being more aware and living life on sort of a different level, I think. So in that way, and also I show you in the book how you can lose weight while drawing too. So if that's your concern, I'll cover that as well.
Danny Gregory, thank you very much for the encouragement.
Sure.
Danny Gregory, co-founder of SketchbookSchool.com, which offers online art classes. He's author of several books, most recently Art Before Breakfast, A Zillion Ways to Be More Creative, No Matter How Busy You Are. And you can find out more about his book and the Sketchbook School and see our in-studio sketches of our hands. Please don't judge at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Part Mythbusters, part Blue Man Group, and part Bill Nye the Science Guy. That's Mike Alberici's program Sound in Focus, which teaches kids to listen, which is a real challenge in American classrooms. Mike, a music teacher, decided to do something about it, and his efforts have taken him to elementary schools across New Hampshire. Word of Mouth intern Fiona Shea has the story.
That was the sound of a vortex cannon going off in the Lamprey River Elementary School in Raymond, New Hampshire. Don't worry, it only shoots air and smoke. And more importantly, it's a fun experiment that teaches kids the science of sound and how to listen.
My name is Mr. Alberici. Let's try to say my name. Al.
Alberici.
Mike Alberici is a music teacher at Maple Street School in Hopkinton. Mr. A, as he's known to many students, is the only music teacher to ever receive the Krista McAuliffe Sabbatical from the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, an award that grants teachers leave to develop new ideas for the classroom and covers all the costs. As a musician and a teacher who's been teaching for 23 years, he has an ear for the way kids talk, and the way kids listen and interact. And a few years ago, he realized that there was a problem.
It was around 2007 and 2008, when Apple released the iPod Touch.
He says that was the first time kids really had the internet in their pockets.
And I started noticing then that they're listening. First, their attention span, their listening attention span started to tank within a couple of years. Like, I used to be able to put on like a movement of a Beethoven symphony And with the right pre-teaching, I could get a class of 20 kids to listen quietly for 9 minutes. By 2010, I noticed that kids were unable to do that.
They were fidgeting. They were drawing. They were reaching for electronics. They were chatting. They couldn't sustain just listening. This tendency to get distracted, Mike calls it swiping behavior, as though kids are treating life as they would an iPad.
If they don't like what you're saying, swipe, you're done. Move on to the next thing. I don't like this music, swipe, you're done.
And so, with the help of the sabbatical, he developed a program called Sound in Focus, a 4-day residency he conducts in schools across the state designed to teach kids how to be mindful listeners and better communicators. But how do you get kids who aren't listening to pay attention?
I knew that on day one, I needed to build some over-the-top sound experiments to show these kids just how incredible sound is, because my focus is I want to inspire them to listen. So I said, okay, we need to inspire them. How do you inspire a fifth grader to listen? You blow his mind.
With his newest musical instrument, a tubulum made out of PVC pipe, Mike not only shows that music and sound can be cool, but also stresses the importance of math. He tells the kids how he couldn't build the instrument without math, but he couldn't do the equation and needed his daughter's help.
Math is everything in the world. Okay, so listen up when your teachers start doing math. That's a word from me to you. Listen.
Day one is when Mr. A breaks out the vortex cannon we heard earlier, and also when the kids try to break the quiet record, a record for being, well, silent. Mike gives the kids 15 seconds to be as quiet as possible.
We're trying to break the record of 55. When you break it, you have to get 54.
To break the record, these kids had to reach an average quietness of 54 decibels.
One, two, three.
This is the sound of 200 kids being absolutely silent. Well, until...
54, you did it.
On days 2, 3, and 4 of the residency, Mr. A goes to each classroom for an hour per day. During the week, kids make an audio map of the school and talk about how the construction of the building affects the sound. They take a self-assessment listening quiz. They do a cymatics experiment, it's the study of making sound visible, using a thick starch-based solution called non-Newtonian fluid that helps students to see sound in motion. Mike puts it on a speaker and controls the frequency.
From 25 to 35, if you give it that frequency, it becomes alive. It turns like into zombie snot.
Okay, so what does zombie snot really have to do with listening? Well, it literally shows kids sound. And anyway, what's going to get kids to listen more than experimenting with a fluid you can describe as zombie snot?
5 or 6 years ago, I realized that I'm really more than a music teacher, that I'm really supposed to be teaching the kids how to listen. Because no one is. You know, they're not getting cues on how to listen actively and how to pay attention to each other and what are good listening traits and bad listening traits. That's not coming from anywhere. And that's kind of why I called it Sound in Focus, because that's what I want them to focus on. I want them to refocus back on their ears.
Why does listening matter? Listening is our access to understanding. It has an impact on the way kids communicate with each other and with the world. So how can teachers and parents better teach their kids to listen to the world around them? Mike says it can be quite simple.
Give kids opportunities to listen. Make some time in your classroom, a minute, just say, okay, we're going to be quiet right now and listen to the radiator.
That's the challenge of generations, to listen. But how else could we teach kids and adults alike to listen mindfully to become better communicators? Well, there's always public radio. For Word of Mouth, I'm Fiona Shea.
And a quick update to this story. Mike Alberici has finished his sabbatical and is back to teaching music full-time in Hopkinton. But he's still presenting Sound in Focus at educational conferences and conventions and at a few one-day residencies. If you'd like Mike to visit your school, you'll find his contact information at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What do human beings most fear? Comedian Jerry Seinfeld knows.
Speaking in front of a crowd is considered the number one fear of the average person. I found that amazing.
Number two was death. Death is number two? This means to the average person, if you have to be at a funeral, you would rather be in the casket than doing the eulogy.
Sarah Solovich knows the fear of being in public all too well. A gifted pianist at a young age, her promising career in music was cut short by crippling stage fright. By her late 50s, she'd had a successful career in journalism, raised three kids, and again felt the tug of her long-lost dream. Then Sarah gave herself a year until her 60th birthday to try everything. Lessons, coaching, cognitive therapy, beta blockers, and playing in airports, hospitals, and retirement homes to get over her anxiety and perform before an audience. Her new book is called Playing Scared, A History and Memoir of Stage Fright. And Sarah, it's so great to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
Your own history, along with the long and sweaty palmed road of stage fright, is in this story. And it's plagued performers from Sarah Bernhardt to Sir Laurence Olivier, Barbara Streisand, Paul McCartney, Vladimir Horowitz, who had an acute reaction to performing. What are some of the ways it showed up for those people?
Well, I just think, you know, anybody can develop a case of stage fright. It's part of the human condition. And there's one wonderful story about Sarah Bernhardt, who was, I think, signing an autograph for a young woman who said that she was an actress. And as she handed the program or whatever she wanted Bernhardt to sign, said, "I never get stage fright." And Sarah Bernhardt looked at her and said, "When you become a real actress, you will."
You showed her. Well, a number of these artists almost gave up careers because of stage fright. Now, how did they get over it?
Well, Horowitz actually did give up a career. He gave it up for 12 years and kind of went into self-imposed exile about it. And even when he came back, he had just developed this regimen, a kind of near autistic-like, you know, demand for having everything the same before a performance. So he would have Dover sole and asparagus flowing into wherever he was. And there's one story in which three burly men actually had to come into his room, the green room in the back of the theater, and actually drag him out of there, kicking and screaming, and throw him on stage. According to all accounts, he gave an absolutely marvelous performance after those kinds of, you know, events.
You detail